This is episode number 2 of Investing from the Beach. Hello and welcome. I'm Chris Hansen. I'm your host. And today I've got the co-host with me, Chris Lamb.
Hi, everyone. Chris Lamb's here.
And if you remember, if you listened to the first episode, you heard a little bit of background on me talking about how I got to where I am and kind of the idea, the genesis for the idea for this podcast. And so I thought today on this episode, it would be helpful to hear a little bit of background on the co-host. He's got a much different perspective or a much different upbringing and background than I do, and also at a different age category. So I think it'd be pretty interesting for everyone to hear that and to understand how the two of us look at things. We see things very similar, but a lot of times coming at it from a very, very different perspective. Chris, you cool with that?
I'm totally cool with that.
So probably the thing that I get a kick out of, or just kind of a different perspective, so you were born in, tell me a little bit about the early upbringing years through.
Yeah, so my situation is definitely, I wasn't born in the South Bay or, raised, in middle class family, but came from Vietnam, actually. Left the country when I was just about 5 years old and spent actually, a good year in the refugee camp, most of the time in the Philippines. Came here, didn't speak any English, right? My parents, actually didn't, up to today, they don't speak English. Kind of had to learn and navigate, the country or just, the American culture, right? Pretty much on my own. And grew up in a community where there was a lot of, cultural differences. So, lots of fights, lots of gangs, even a best friend of mine, growing up with him from 7, 8 years old all the way to about 12, 13 years old when he passed away, got shot, right? But I for some reason, I was a little different than the guys that, I hung out with, in that I cared about school and I cared about money. I cared about saving. I cared about, being successful. And I think when I reflected back, what made me, started saving, it's an interesting story, and I think I shared with Chris once here. It was actually my brother, right? And he's got the scar on his back to prove it. I started out, I was probably 2-3 years old, right? Maybe still wearing diapers at the time. And my brother made me some promise that if I did something or if I agreed to something, and he would buy me some ice cream or something like that. And then the ice cream man came by. This is in Vietnam. And, I asked him, hey, go get me some ice cream. And he refused. And then, I knew he had a piggy bank or whatever he kept his money in. So I ran after it. He stopped me. And just, he wasn't going to stop me. So I bit him. Right. And up to this day, he has that scar on his back. I just recall back, why did I bite him? And it was because he didn't buy me any ice cream, and he had control of the money. And ever since then, I didn't want that to happen again, where someone, had to buy me things. And I think that's what started me saving. And every day, my parents would give me money, right? Growing up in Vietnam, every day, 3 years old, all the way to 5 years old, I saved every bit of it. I did not buy any thing that day, knowing that I don't need to buy food, they're going to buy me food. So I saved actually a pretty good chunk of money, and that kind of started me saving.
And so if the ice cream man came by, you were ready for him if you wanted to, otherwise you'd tap into mom or dad for the cash.
Exactly. And so somehow I just, I guess that made me really interested in saving dollars and accumulating dollars.
Interesting. I love that. I get a kick out of that story, and I know your brother, so that even makes it more humorous. And so you grew up in a suburb of LA, San Gabriel Valley area, right? Heavy Asian immigrant population.
Correct.
Certainly not with a silver spoon. So you got out of high school, went on to college, and at that point you started working in an MLM business, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, at the time, actually, when I was in college, I went there for physical therapy. I had nothing to do with business or money or finance. And one of the guys that I was in class with, was in a multi-level marketing company and said, hey, you wanted to recruit me. Had no idea what it was about, but, they sold financial services. And it got me introduced into the whole world of finance and money, right? And I thought, you know, it gave me a very, very good experience and made me, you know, see the value of saving and growing that dollar over time and having it work for me. And that kind of triggered my curiosity into stocks, into, you know, the stock market.
And so you had like a securities license and an insurance license at what, like 19?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. So part of being in the multi-level marketing business is, you know, we had to be licensed. So I was, you know, I had my securities license and I also had my insurance license and recruited, you know, actually a decent sized team, but the team that I had was all, you know, the same age as I was at the time. So it was very tough to run a, you know, financial services business with a bunch of
19-year-olds,
teenies,
interesting,
or guys that are basically in early 20s, right? And so I kind of stepped away from that, and you know, at the time was also introduced into the corporate world as well at IBM. So kind of just, it made sense to just transition there into sales.
And so it's funny. So you started this when you were 19. I started when I was probably 28 to 30, somewhere in that range. Right. So we had, you had an 11-year jump on me as far as when
you got
interested.
No, you're talking about stock market.
Yeah, exactly. Just kind of learning a little bit about finance, right? You started when you weren't even out of school. And I'd been probably 10 years out of school by the time that I started.
Yep.
And then you start the story on how you get interested in the stock market. This was your cousin coming to you during the dot-com boom, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I think it was at the end of 1999, right? It was just, you know, it could have been December, January. And we were at a barbecue. You know, he was throwing a barbecue and he was telling me, he's like, you know, and at the time I was also a licensed security. So, you know, I had some interest in the stock market. So naturally we had a conversation about money. And he said, he told me, hey, the market's been up like crazy, right? You know, he was bragging that he was pulling in, you know, a few thousand dollars every day because it was up every day. And so I said, naturally, why didn't you tell me about it, right? And he said, you're too young. I said, what do you mean? So he got me set up, right? I naturally opened up an account and just deposited about $1,500 in there. And, you know, I asked him, hey, what should I trade? He gave me a symbol. I bought that symbol, right? And a week later, I sold it. And I just realized my account was at, you know, $1,500. Now it's $2,500.
So rocketed up that much that quick.
Yeah. I mean, it didn't take me to be a math genius, right, to realize that was a huge percentage on a very short amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just, hey, let's throw some more dollars in it. And I had no idea what I was doing. All I knew was money was making money. And so I got addicted, I guess, you know.
It is a drug.
Had no idea it was at the height of the dot-com, right, bubble. And so market came crashing down. I was still trading. The only way that I knew how to trade was to buy low and sell high. So I kept on buying lower and lower.
And
some of the stocks that I've had, it never went higher, right? And then I think I met you, Chris,
mm-hmm.
around, was it about 2000, right?
Yep.
Going towards the end of 2000 or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I approached Chris. I asked him, what should I trade? Or what should I read? What should I do about the stock market? He told me, you know, hey, what do you buy and sell? And I couldn't answer him.
Well, and you came to me because of the secretary in the office, wasn't it? Where you asked her, who knows this? And she pointed towards me and says, he knows a little something about it.
Yep. Yep. So I approached Chris. She's one of the assistant of the executive that I was reporting to as an intern, told me, hey, you should talk to Chris since she knew I was very curious about the stock market. So I approached Chris and Chris was, you know, drawing a bunch of stuff on the, you know, or the whiteboard and, you know, I had no idea what he was doing, but it, you know, seemed like he knew something. So he gave me some instructions to go read books, right? Told me how to, or that I should go and learn or read. And so I started picking up, the book and read. And then he asked me a few weeks later, hey, what are you up to? So I shared with him what I learned. And just, you know, Chris kind of was very shocked that I actually followed through and, you know, read and followed his advice.
Because I'd been asked for years. People all the time would come up and say, "Hey, you know, you're pretty quiet about it, but you know something about the stock market. Tell me, you know, what can you show me? How do I learn?" And I used to tell people all the time, go pick up this book. At the time, it was called How to Make Money in Stocks. It's William O'Neill. It's the guy that writes Investor's Business Daily, founded Investor's Business Daily. It's a competitor to the Wall Street Journal. And I said, the first time you read it, it'll make no sense. Just plow through it. Don't try and learn it. Just get through what you can. And I would tell people, it'll take you three times going through it. Well, you came up to me and asked the same question. I said, go buy the book. I don't remember sometimes I would buy it for people. And other times I'd say, buy it, and saying, if you don't like it, I'll buy it back from you. And I said, go read it. And again, first time it'll make no sense. Second time it'll start to sink. Third time, stuff will be more clear. And I've said that to people for probably 5 years prior to that, as we're going through this, you know, nice big bull market in the mid and late 90s, and nobody ever would do it. And you're the first guy that ever did it. And at that point, a great friendship was formed.
Yeah, I had no idea who Chris was at the time as well. Just, you know, here's this guy and, you know, walking around the office, right? And I don't see him much because, you know, we're mobile. So we're all, you know, working away from the corporate office, or at least the actual, you know, company office. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when I got a chance to, you know, sit with them on some sales, you know, call and actually go out to lunch as well, you know, got to know him better and realized that, you know, hey, Chris spends a lot of his time teaching, you know, kids around the community in, you know, elementary school as well about money and finance. And you know, he really enjoys this stuff, right? And so I think, you know, you guys are definitely you guys are definitely privileged to be able to, you know, listen to him in the podcast, because this wasn't available when I was, you know, young, or even at that time, you know, early IBM career.
Yeah, I tell people all the time, I wish I would have found, it sounds arrogant, I don't mean it arrogant, but I wish I would have found somebody that could have kind of told me what not to waste my time reading, or what not to waste my time trying to study and figure out, and kind of give you a checklist, you know, go read this, you know, these 3, 4, 5, 12 books, whatever it is, try this. And it makes the path much faster. But, you know, if you don't have it, you got to go through the, what do you call it? The learning curve of trial and error and blood, sweat, and tears, and a lot of cursing, a lot of crying. And just, you know, as I tell people, just, you know, get back in the boat, sit down, shut up and row, and just keep pulling at it.
And that's if you don't quit.
Correct. Yeah, exactly. If the frustration doesn't kick in.
Another thing that you don't know about Chris is just kind of shows you what kind of person he is, you know, when I turned 21 years old, went out, you know, with the coworkers and stuff after work. You know, they took me out to happy hours, had some beers and stuff, you know, and, you know, some of them bought me drinks. Chris bought me a, you know, subscription to Investor's Business Daily, right? A 2-year subscription. He probably paid a few hundred dollars at the time. And he had no idea, you know, he had no relationship with me, really, no interest other than to see me succeed. And I really, really appreciate that. And, you know, I think that really truly puts or shows you what type of person Chris is.
But from my side, that was a really good investment. So I don't even remember what it cost, probably a few $100. But yeah, look what it's turned into. So that was a great ROI on my part. Very, very, very simple. So when you finished,
thank you, Chris.
You're very welcome. My pleasure. And thank you. So you worked at IBM through college, and about the time you were making at IBM, what, maybe $10 an hour working part-time while you're going to, and you're going to what, Long Beach State, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And you're making ballpark 10 an hour?
Yeah, 12, $13 an hour, something like that.
And when you finished at IBM, I love this story. Do you remember how much cash you had in the bank approximately?
I had about $40,000.
And you'd had this by learning to trade, and you're dabbling in the market, staying disciplined at it, and at the time not really understanding it. And this was during when the market is falling.
Correct.
And you're figuring out how to make. So you got a kid coming out of school with 40 grand, making $10 an hour. So there's definitely I think you're born to do that. I'm not sure. I think you learn how to do it, but what I was thrilled, I was seeing, it's like, this guy has a knack for it. And you had shared a story too. I remember as a kid, you were saying something about marbles. You know, tell the marble story where you used to.
Marble stories. Yeah. I mean, I'm just reflecting on my background about, you know, just how did I go about, you know, accumulating money or just focusing on, you know, where the dollars are at. I guess, you know, I had an interest in marbles, right? As a kid, I think it was for some reason, when you're, you know, in elementary school, certain age or certain years, something is popular. So at that time, marbles was very popular in the schools. And somehow I just, you know, I was just the best at marbles. So, you know, I would, you know, play marbles with kids, and they call it for keeps. So, you know, we would win each other's marbles. You know, I started out with basically, I've never bought one marble. I don't know how I got my first one, but I got it. And I accumulated thousands of marbles over the course of a year and a half, maybe, to the point that no other kids want to play me marbles.
The Marble King of Monterey Park, California.
And, you know, I don't know how much money I made, but I would say at least over $100 in selling the marbles back to the kids.
That's cool. And this is as an elementary school, as an 8-10-year-old kid.
Correct. Yeah, I was about 9 years old at the time.
So wheel and deal in Monterey Park marbles. That's cool. So you finished. Finished up at Long Beach. Got hired by IBM. And I like this story. You started late in the year, September, October, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
And when they hired you, at the time, you had the ability to sign up for the 401k.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And they trying to think. Tell the story about the percentages that you could put in and what you chose to do. And to me, then the reason I ask people this is it really shows the importance of how to think. It's not the how to do, it's the how to think.
Yeah, so what Chris is referring to is, you know, when I first started going full-time with IBM right out of school, college, and I started late in the year, it was basically October, and I had 2-3 months to, you know, participate in the 401k program. And so at the time, I knew that, hey, the 401k program allows you to grow money, tax deferred, right? Also, the company also matches money. And so I wanted to at least try to contribute the max that I could, right, in that year. And I think at the time, you could put a certain amount of thousands of dollars or something like that. I don't remember how much.
Ballpark, like 10, you're saying, like, let's see, just for discussion, like 10 grand from the federal. So the federal limit was
whatever that limit was at the time.
Whatever it was, right? Yep.
So there was a limit that you could put in at the federal tax limit, and I wanted to be able to max it out. And so I dug into the 401k program. It allowed me to put 80% of my check, right? And so, you know, I went and asked and confirmed to see if I can do that, right, with the HR manager at the time. And he told me you couldn't. He said, no, you shouldn't be doing that, or you can't. It was weird because, you know, I didn't believe him because here it said it kind of plainly in the language. You can put 80%. So what I did was I, you know, just went ahead and did it because no one else ever did that. Right. And so I put in 80%, and sure enough, right, when I got my paycheck, it was like $67 or something.
And your salary at IBM at the time was, do you remember how much?
IBM salary, I think it was about 50, 60,000.
So making ballpark 60 grand a year. So whatever that is, what, 5 grand a month, and your first paycheck is less than $100.
Yeah.
And because it all went into the 401k. And so you did that for the month of November and December.
Correct.
And then thus matched out the federal match that first 2 months.
The first two months, yeah, 2-3 months there.
And I remember having this discussion with him on the phone. We had a discussion saying, hey, I'm thinking of doing this. What do you think? And what we looked at was, and again, this goes back to how to think. If you make the assumption that you're going to put, let's say, 10 grand a year, whatever contribution you're going to make towards your 401k, and you do that year after year after year after year after year, you don't really notice it. You know, in year two, you're going to have 20 grand, right? Because of the first year contribution plus the second year contribution.
Yep.
And then the growth of whatever you get on that money.
Plus the company match.
Yeah, exactly. You get that as well. Where it really becomes interesting is when you look at year 40 and you say, okay, let's say that I worked there 40 years. And then, good God, I don't want to, but let's assume that I do. And you don't know what the federal limits will be at that point. So I think we just ran the spreadsheet of saying, let's just assume it stays at 10 grand a year. We know it's going to increase, but just to make it simple. And then you say, well, if I had one more year, what is the balance? And so
that's right.
That's really the impact that you see. So putting the 10 grand this year, it just meant, you know, he dipped into savings to live for 2 months. Where you see the benefit is 40 years down the road. If I remember right, it was something like $6 million. I probably have that spreadsheet.
Something ridiculous.
Just ridiculous. And you think, you know what, for the opportunity for $6 million in 40 years, it's worth living a little, you know, living on $67 a month or whatever you need to do for 2 months to get you going. But to me, that's just an incredible, a great example of how to think. There's a great book about this, about Don't Eat the Marshmallow Yet. I think we'll cover that in an upcoming podcast. But it's about delayed gratification.
And that's what really, I think, is my story, right? It's I don't think I have a knack for anything, like Chris said, but it's really, I think, I've understood, or at least somehow was ingrained in me, about delayed gratification, because, you know, I was given money every day, and sure enough, I could use it to go buy something.
But you didn't.
But
do
I
it.
Did not. Right? I was 3 years old when I left Vietnam. I was about 5 years old, and I don't know how much money I had, but based on what my mom told me, I mean, I can kind of compare in today's dollars, right? It's kind of like, you gave your child, you know, a couple bucks every day, right?
Okay.
For 2 years. And, you know, at the end of those 2 years, he kept everything, and he might have had more because other people gave it to him. Mm-hmm. So I had about, you know, probably $1,500 or more. Right. And that was getting, you know, less than $5 every day.
Yep. And squirreled away under the mattress in Vietnam.
Yep.
That's cool. That's very cool. So we started at IBM, and you ended up working in a call center, right, where you were on the phone the whole time. So it was a sales organization, but you were doing...
I was doing inside sales, right? So I was basically doing selling on the phone, right, or supporting clients in California.
And so while you were doing that, you were also, I don't know if I use the word dabbling, but you were definitely involved with the stock market pretty actively.
Yes. So I left California, started my full-time career at IBM out in Dallas. So it was over in Texas for a few years out there. While I was out there, I continued to learn the stock market, right? Kept in touch with Chris. Chris had already retired at the time. And, you know, I just knew that, you know, working for a company was not what I wanted to do, and I didn't want to spend the rest of my life working for the money as well. So I knew I wanted to retire, I guess you can say, early. And so I knew that the best way that I knew at the time was just the stock market, that it could, you know, provide that for me, money working for money. And so I continue that effort. IBM or any other job, right, was really second. So continue to learn the stock market, and was doing quite a bit of day trading. I think at the time we were sitting in a cubicle, and one of the managers came by, right, or actually my manager came by, and, you know, saying, hey, you know, was trying to chat with me about some sales numbers or some stuff, and, you know, and it probably meant a few hundred dollars in commission to me. And at the time I probably had about $400,000, you know, on a trade that I had to watch. And here he is, just, you know, and I had to switch the screen right away.
Yep.
I couldn't leave it, you know. And I was like, in my head, I was thinking, get the F out of here, man. I can't have this conversation right now. But I guess my body language was disinterested, so he didn't stay very long.
That's cool. I can remember this one time where you had called in the morning, and I was in L.A. I'd already quit. And there was some stock, I think we both had been watching, and you had traded it, and you'd been in for, I don't know, however long it was, you made a few $1,000. I'd made a few bucks on it as well. And I think we called and said, hey, did you catch it? Yeah, I caught it. All right, I'll talk to you later. You went off to work, right? And you're 2 hours ahead of me. So it's probably, I don't know, 9 or 10 a.m. Dallas time, whatever time you went in. And I remember getting a phone call later on that day that said, I don't know how much longer I can do this. I need to talk to you. It's like, okay, what's up? You said, you know, I just made a few $1,000 this morning on a trade, and it was calm. It was cool. Everything worked great. It was exactly what I expected. And I walk into a session today, and I had to listen to some guy talk to me for an hour and a half about getting me excited about selling some great product for the next 3 months. And if I do well, I get a $50 Starbucks gift card as a bonus, right? Some of that effect. And I just giggled. It's like, well, we all have different levels of understanding of finance, and you just got to grind it out. They're paying you a dollar. Suck it up till you're ready to leave.
So I did suck it up. I stayed at IBM actually till about the beginning of 2012.
Okay. And so then when you left, I wish I would have been there to see this, but I remember helping you or, you know, giving some input on writing the retirement letter.
Mm-hmm.
And you wrote a retirement letter at, how old were you, 31?
I was 31, yes.
And sent a blast email out to everyone that basically said, I'm retired.
Yeah, you know, usually, when you're in corporate America, an employee leaves the company, especially after being there for a long time, you have to kind of write a, you know, cordial email to say farewell and, you know, here's what I'm going to be doing next, or I'm going to be doing something, right? Mm-hmm. Just kind of, you know, just thank you for, you know, all this, you know, all the support and everything that you, you know, people that you work with.
Correct.
You know, my email had a little bit of that, but, you know, just a small piece. And the bulk of it was just to say, hey, you know, I'm really done, right? I'm not, you know, looking for another you know, job or moving on to, you know, bigger and better things. It just really says, hey, I got time freedom. I'm, you know, retiring from corporate America and enjoying my, you know, my life. And so there was a pretty interesting response. I got a lot of people were very shocked. And, you know, they, in fact, a few of them actually reached out to me and asked for advice and guidance as well.
And so you have people that have been working at IBM longer than you've been on the planet.
Correct.
And you hear you're leaving and retiring and they don't know, their world was spun.
Yep. And yeah. And I had no idea what that meant early, you know, when I left, you mm-hmm. know, because I've always worked.
Yes.
Right. But I think the message there is, you know, after leaving IBM and after leaving, you know, not having to work for corporate America or anyone, I think the mindset changes, or at least it really confirms what, you know, what I've heard about, you know, time freedom and retirement, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's really, really liberating. And, you know, to be truly, you know, spend your life doing the things that you want to do, like sharing this stuff on this podcast, helping others, right? Doing more meaningful things.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that is just so underrated, and people have no idea until they taste it. And part of, you know, me wanting to join Chris Hansen here to share, right, what I know or what, you know, my experience and sharing the message, right, to help those out there to see this, so that you guys can get to time freedom, enjoy your life as well.
When I get a kick out of it too, it's like, you know, there are a lot of people that you and I both know, both together, people, you know, people I know, and a lot of people, we friends we share in common.
Where, and very close with.
Exactly. But also where you'll see that there are two people that I know that are approximately your age. In fact, even older, it doesn't matter, where both the mom and the dad, the husband and the wife, are quote unquote unemployed by choice. Right, they've hit time freedom and they're raising young kids. It's one thing if they retire at 50, 60 years old and the kids are out of the house, and kind of the empty nest syndrome. It's another thing when you've got a brand new member of the family that joins the nest. And it's one, you know, people say, oh, I want to be able to work so that my wife can stay home and raise the kids. But I think it's awesome that you get mom and dad both able to stay home and raise the kids. Right, you can do that. We've got a friend, you know who I'm talking about down here that can
correct.
Do that.
Yeah, yep. That's so true. I mean, I'm so blessed to be able to have, you know, that time to spend with my daughter every day.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see the value of it, you know, as a parent, you know, before being a parent. Until being a parent, I realized, man, what a blessing to have the time and be able to enjoy that with her, you know, every single moment. So, you know, even during this podcast, sometimes you might hear a baby
hear in the background,
you know, yep, in the background. So then you know what that is.
That's cool. But but the key point, one is that's powerful, but two, it's definitely doable. And it all boils down to, it's not so much the how to do, right? You and I both did it in real estate.
Mm-hmm.
And the other friend we're talking about, or you and I both did it in stock market. The other buddy we know did it in real estate. It's interesting if you talk to you and I about the amount of work that it took and you talk to him about the amount of work that it took. You and I are not interested in going to learn real estate and he's sitting learning the stock market from us. And that to me there's a huge message there. It can be done in either one, but one has a lot more effort. One may have a longer learning curve.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's that. And then it's also one of the things that you and I have talked about many times is if I work as an employee somewhere and I want to double my income, just I'm picking double because it's an easy number. Or if I'm self-employed and I want to double my income, I got to work double the hours, get double the salary, or double my hourly rate, or, you know, charge double for a project. But in the stock market, I just need to build up my capital to buy double the number of shares, right? And there's really no upside limit to that. The limit becomes what's in my own head about where I start to freak out about the money. And that's a totally different way of thinking than I've seen that people are, that look at it from a job perspective where you're trading your time for dollars.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a cool spot to be. What else? Anything else you wanted to add that you think might be helpful for people to know about you?
Well, I think the message here is to let you guys, or you know, you guys that are listening out there, that there's nothing, you know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to do what I did, right?
Neither one of us was born with a silver spoon.
It's really about delayed gratification, and it comes down to, are you able to save?
Mm-hmm.
Right? You don't need, you know, a high-paying job. Whatever your pay is, can you spend less than that, and can you save a little bit of money? And you'll be amazed at how much money you can accumulate over time. And along the way, you just got to go and learn. You have to, you know, learn how money works and how you can get money working for you. And if you can put that together over the, you know, course of a relatively very short amount of years, you can get to time freedom.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to be 65 or 70 and collect pensions and, you know, wait for Social Security or whatever it is. Or you know, until you can't work anymore. You don't need to do that. So, you know, that's my story, or that's my background. How I got to, you know, time freedom was no, you know, it wasn't tough. It wasn't, you know, there's no secrets there, right? I graduated from a regular, you know, college. And you know what? If I didn't have my degree, it probably didn't even matter. I would just go work for somewhere, you know, somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I would still save. And I would still learn the stock market.
It's the consistent application in a disciplined fashion, doing it again and again and again. Did you see the article? There was a recent article out. Buffett and Gates were both interviewed, and they said, hey, if you had to start all over again, you know, you're born today or you lost it all, what would you start off as? And mm-hmm. Buffett said, oh, instantly, I'd be an investor. Right? And Gates was, I think he had said he would go into AI, start a company in AI. And I think he might also have said investing, but neither one of them talked about going to get a job. It was, you know, figuring out how to have assets or how to have resources working for you. And these are the guys that are at the top of the heap from a financial view.
And that's because they have that certain mindset, mm-hmm. right? That's there. Yeah, if we don't have that mindset, or we have the we talked about the 5%, right, versus the 95%,
mm-hmm.
right? If we were like the mindset of that 95%, or if they were, then yes, they're going to go back and say, hey, let me just start out as an employee.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the things, too, I think we're going to cover this in a future podcast episode. If you've read Kiyosaki's Cash Flow Quadrant, in there he talks about basically what I think of as four sources of income, right? You could either be a wage earner or an employee. You could be self-employed. You could own a business or own a system, or you can invest in a business. I mean, Chris, you and speak from my own side. I would call myself an investor and a self-employed person now. And I do the self-employed to kind of keep me busy and occupied. And I've been the employee route. I don't really know that I own by his definition of a business. I'm not really sure I understand what that means. You and I have come up with the idea, or kind of a similar model, if you will. And what do you call it? The money triangle?
Yeah, we call it the money triangle.
And the three.
So basically, it's instead of four ways that money flow to you, it's really just three ways, and it all focuses around a business,
mm-hmm.
right? And so one of the sides of the triangle is. You know, it's you can, similar to Kiyosaki, is self-employed, or, you know, what Chris uses coin is where you earn wages,
mm-hmm.
right? So that's where the bulk of people are. is, you know, in the self-employed and earning wages or welfare side. The other way that money can flow is being self-employed. You know, you're actually, you know, running a business that you, you know, are you know, or cannot be run without you, right? Which you could see a lot of small business owners, right? For example, a little, you know, gas station or something like that, or a mom and pop shop, right? Liquor store, right? Those are all self-employed businesses where if the owner is not involved, right, it's not going to run right correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third way is really money working for you is, you know, money earning for you is being an investor, right? Is the other side of, or the, you know, the last side of the triangle, is being an investor and having money work for you. So, you know, you could take a look at what Buffett and Gates are doing, right? Even if Gates is working for a certain, for Microsoft, right? Before, he chose to be an employee, but he didn't have to work at Microsoft, and he owned more than, you know, 50% of the shares at the time. And so, you know, he was also an investor. And so the bulk of his money is earned through being an investor at Microsoft, not as an employee.
And so we're going to say we're
going to. So those are the three ways that money can come to you as income. And, you know, the side that, you know, most people are on is the employee. You think in terms of the business. As an employee, you work for the business. And as a self-employee or as a self-employer, you own the business. I mean, you are the business. So that means the business does not work without you. It involves your time. And the other side of the triangle, as an investor, you own the business. You truly own it. It does. It works. It runs independently from you. And it does not require any of your time. And so if we talk about in terms of time freedom, the only way that you can get truly, you know, get time freedom is to be an investor, is to have money work for you. And it doesn't involve any of your time.
I think what's always been interesting to me, and I, as you said before, and I've talked with lots and countless people over the years, I hear constantly people say, well, and some people enjoy their job, some people, you know, can't stand it, despise it, whatever they are on that spectrum of job enjoyment. They'll often say, you know, if I could leave my job, I would do this, but I don't really like what I'm doing. And then in the next breath, they talk about how they have to go work on this project or go do something to kiss up to their boss to try and qualify for the raise for next year. And they're trying to either get the promotion or the raise, so they're going to make another, you know, 2, 5, 10, 15, 20% a year, whatever it is. And on a raise, usually it's a handful of a percent. If they can get a promo, you're right, you might get into the double digit. And if I ask them and say, well, how much time do you spend trying to grow your 401k balance? You go, oh, none. You know, I roll the money in every month and just, you know, hope and pray it's going to be big when the time comes to draw on it. And I'll sit and show them and say, well, imagine if you could, just in theory, get another percentage point or two or maybe even three out of your 401k returns. Have you ever looked at what that would mean years down the road? And I met with a blank stare. And a lot of times I won't take the time to show it to them. I just plant the seed and see if they'll run with it. But if you look at those for somebody who's in their 20s or 30s, the number is astronomical. You can't make that much in a job. People will spend their time complaining about the job and spend time working toward getting a raise. Then in the long term, isn't going to help that much. And they won't spend time on working on their biggest asset. And it just always floors me. But we'll cover that in a future episode as well.
And that's an example of how to think.
Yes.
It's a mindset thing.
Yep, it's a total mindset thing. So with that, Chris, do you have any other comments we should add?
I think that gives, it should give, our listeners or our audience enough of a background about myself. And hopefully what I've shared, would stick with some of you guys. And, that's my goal is, right, it's really to share that message, that story to help those that are kind of like, hey, how could I, get to time freedom,
mm-hmm.
right? And how could I save, right? That's how. It doesn't take much.
Just a consistent, disciplined application of doing the same stuff again and again and again.
Yeah, and we also touched on the money triangle,
mm-hmm.
and so we'll talk about that a little bit more and what that means to you and how to think around that in the upcoming podcast.
Now, one thing I'd like you to do, I'd like you for a moment to close your eyes. If you're driving, please don't. Just use your imagination. But for those of us that aren't driving, close your eyes and picture in your mind's eye a large jumbo jet. Let's say it's a 747. So a big, huge airplane. And now picture that you're getting on board that 747 airplane. Now, if you're on that 747, my belief is that within about 24 hours, I think you can get to probably just about any beach on the planet that you'd want to go to. Think about that for a second. You get on a 747, and within 24 hours, you can get to any beach. And that is our phone number, 747-24-BEACH, 747-24-BEACH. If you have questions, if you have comments, if you have a suggestion for a topic you'd like us to discuss in a future episode, call that number, leave us a message. The nice thing about that is, if in a few days from now, something may pop into your brain, some kind of a question or a topic you'd like us to discuss, give us a call. You'll remember that phone number, on a 747, in 24 hours, you can be at the beach. If you'd rather email us, investingfromthebeach@gmail.com. investingfromthebeach@gmail.com. As we get near the end of this episode, I want you to listen to something, the next few seconds of a sound clip I'm going to play, and then I want you to think about it. If I were to ask you what that sound was, most people say, oh, that's obvious. That was waves crashing on the beach. But, you know, most of you don't recognize that sound for what it really was. It was much more than just waves crashing on the beach, because those weren't just any waves. Those were Tuesday waves. Now, how do I know? Well, I went to the beach near my home. I was in Huntington Beach, California, and I literally recorded waves on a Tuesday. Now, in case you didn't know this, Tuesday waves sound incredible. Most people only get to hear Saturday and Sunday waves. They don't know the secret of Tuesday waves. Let me tell you, I promise you, Tuesday waves sound so much better. The reason the two of us do this podcast is that we know that if you'll take what we're going to talk about in these podcasts, and if you'll apply it to your investing and your trading and in your life, then you too can eventually always hear Tuesday waves. And once you hear Tuesday waves, you'll agree that they are much, much better than the waves that everybody else has to hear on Saturdays and Sundays. Thank you for spending time with us. Until next time.